I think plant-based is part of that solution. I think cultivator lab-grown meat is part of that solution. At the end of the day, for the consumer, it's going to come down to a few things: taste, texture, experience, price as well is a huge one.
Welcome to Someone Like You, the podcast where we challenge the old rules of business to build something better. I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert, entrepreneur, and host of the podcast, here to guide you through the new frontier of entrepreneurship, where sustainability isn't just an ideal, it's a competitive advantage. Big businesses built the rules of the game by prioritizing profits over people and the planet, but it's time to rewrite that playbook. This show dives into data-backed insights, groundbreaking ideas, and real-world strategies to help you outthink and outmaneuver the status quo. Together, let's break the rules strategically and create a future where bold ideas thrive. Today, we're diving into a topic that's reshaping dinner tables and disrupting an industry built over centuries: the future of meat.
More than a third of our land is being used for animal agriculture. And simply put, we're going to run out of space to make all these products we need and all this meat protein that the world wants. And we need to figure out a solution to that. We need to start producing these products in new ways. I think plant-based is going to play a big part in that, especially some of these, you know, interesting new types of alternatives. I think cultivated meat is going to play a huge part in that as well. I mean, you even have some of the largest meat companies in the space, like Cargill, like Tyson, investing in cultivated or lab-grown meat because they see this shortage. They want to hedge their bets. And I'm really excited to see, you know, how the market evolves over the next 10, 20 years.
With global meat demand set to double over the next few decades and the limits of traditional animal agriculture becoming painfully clear, think factory farming, land depletion, and environmental strain, there is an urgent need for change. Joining me is Mitchell Scott, a visionary leader who once led the Very Good Butchers, a company that soared to a valuation of nearly $1 billion before ultimately stumbling under the pressures of rapid growth and market conditions. Now Mitchell is back with the Better Butchers, a bold new venture giving plant-based meats a completely new texture.
So this time around, we've designed the production process to be much more fast and efficient. For example, like our taco stuffer, which was one of our old favorites, took about 2 days to produce. It was labor intensive. It, you know, took forever. Now we can make a much better product in, you know, 30 minutes to an hour.
Are we ready to embrace proteins that taste the same, they look the same, and they might just be better for us, only made in new and revolutionary ways? And how can businesses seize this opportunity to drive both sustainability and profitability? Let's uncover the answers as we explore the blueprint for a more sustainable food system. Mitchell, welcome to the Someone Like You podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Marco. Pleasure to be here.
We kind of want to start on just marketing and the market opportunity. So you have an interesting story, founded two different businesses, but really kind of glued on this market opportunity that we need to eat more plant-based meats. And so, you know, from going from one company, the Very Good Butchers, to the Better Butchers, and this theme of plant-based meats, I want to kind of explore that market opportunity and how you saw that. And maybe we'll start with the Very Good Butchers and early idea and spark that got you to start thinking about we need alternative meat products. Mitchell's realization at a family barbecue that plant-based options lacked quality highlighted a major gap in the market. With the plant-based food market projected to reach $77.8 billion by 2025, his early insight tapped into a growing demand for healthier, sustainable alternatives.
So call it, I guess, 8 or 10 years ago, I was back home on a little island called Demon Island up in the Comox Valley. I was at a family barbecue and I had this incredible veggie burger. Taste, texture, I was just really, really good. I'd grown up vegetarian. I'd eaten a lot of not so great veggie burgers. And I met the guy, the husband and wife team that were making them, and they were distantly related to me. So it was my sister's brother's sister's sister and her husband. And they were just making these products, selling them at the local farmer's market. For me, I had always wanted to start a business, had never had what I thought was a good idea, to be honest, or a good product. And yeah, it just kind of clicked. You know, at the time, there weren't a ton of great options out there. And they really had incredible products, you know, blend of, you know, beans, veggies, herbs and spices, great nutrition, but I think more importantly, great taste, texture, mouthfeel. And we, yeah, just decided to kind of team up and see where we could take it.
And when you had this, and it's all, you know, from ingredients that you can just grab from your fridge and pantry and kind of put together, which is really special, how did that go from the next stage? So you had this product, it was delicious, and, you know, you're selling at a small little island off Vancouver Island. What was the next step to take it to market, really?
The Vegan Butcher Shop was a strategic move to directly connect with consumers and build loyalty. By replicating the traditional butcher shop model, Mitchell helped make plant-based products approachable in a market where trust and familiarity really matter.
Yeah. So, I mean, at that time, James had started the business. He was a classically trained French chef from England. So great understanding of flavor, how to combine things, deliver that really great taste and texture. And yeah, it was just kind of a summer side project for them at the time. But the response we were getting at that farmer's market was overwhelmingly positive, right? They were selling out. There were people coming back. You know, they couldn't keep up with demand. You know, they were making everything in their kitchen. So we thought, okay, you know, summer's wrapping up. Farmer's market season is coming to a close. Where should we take this? And the thought was, okay, what's the next closest big market? You know, I'd grown up on this island, but moved to Victoria for high school. So, you know, had roots there, and the thought was, okay, you know, Victoria seems manageable. Vancouver's still kind of big and unknown. So let's try do something in Victoria. You know, at the time, production was still very limited, and we didn't know what we were doing, to be honest. So we thought, what about this idea of a vegan or a plant-based butcher shop? Let's open a little, you know, restaurant butcher shop. That way we can sell all the products directly, you know, because we're production limited, make better margin there, and use it as kind of a marketing business building tool. Essentially an extension of that farmer's market experience, but with a brick and mortar physical location. So that was the next step. We opened, I want to say it was February. So, you know, market wound down. We kind of started putting everything in place, opened up, and I want to say in February. And, you know, we'd done one or two pop-ups in Victoria before. And to be honest, we were blown away. We had about 1,000 people show up on our opening day. People were lining up for like 5-6 hours. It was incredible. And from there, we were like, okay, maybe we're onto something. There's very clearly a demand for these types of products and really a huge amount of enthusiasm and excitement.
But when you started this, who did you think your audience was? Because this is roughly, you said, about 9 or 10 years ago. Were you thinking vegans primarily as your audience? Like, I guess at that point, this notion that obviously climate change is happening, obviously we know it, and we've known that the market has changed because of it. And we'll probably talk about some other plant-based companies in the market later on. But at that time, were you trying to cater to vegans? Was that kind of the core audience?
So yeah, this was definitely before the rise of the flexitarian. But our thought was, if we can put out something that delivers this really positive experience that looks great, that tastes great, we didn't want to just cater to, you know, vegans and vegetarians. We thought that would be probably our core initial demographic, and it absolutely was. But by having that presence, you know, we kind of got word of mouth. And, you know, I think at times probably half of our customer base wasn't necessarily vegan or vegetarian. They just heard that we had great food. They wanted to come check it out. This idea of a vegan butcher was something that kind of piqued interest. You know, we got a lot of news coverage from that. We got a lot of people just stopping by to check it out and then trying the products and having a really positive experience.
Targeting flexitarians, who now make up 42% of plant-based food consumers, expanded the brand's potential audience. This strategy positioned the products for mainstream appeal beyond the vegan community.
And from there, you know, I'm thinking, like, why did 1,000 people show up? You know, was it that there was not many options in the market, or was it a combination of that plus the fact that they just, you know, you were selling out at the farmer's market, a lot of publicity, and the products were just really, really good? Or was it just kind of a combination of everything? Because, you know, to start something that had never really been done before, it's great. But for that many people to show up, like, something really must have kind of ticked for people.
Yeah. So I think it was a combination. I think there weren't a lot of options, like in terms of kind of restaurant, somewhere you could actually go for vegans and vegetarians in Victoria at that time. I think we did a couple pop-ups beforehand to generate interest. So put it out on these Facebook groups, got people checking out the product, have had a few bites there, got them excited. And then I think like a day or two before, Czech News came in and did a piece and put it on their Facebook. And it was like their most watched segment of the year or something crazy like that. And it was interesting. It was like a decent chunk of the people commenting were like very anti, you know, you can't have a vegan butcher shop. Meat is the only way. You got to go hunt your meat, et cetera, et cetera. And then you'd have people on the vegan side jumping in, responding. And as a result of that, it got a ton of traction and discussion and interest. But yeah, I mean, when we opened that doors that day, there was already a huge line. We were like, oh shit, you know, what have we done? So I think it was really just a confluence of an interesting, unique take on the market with this butcher shop aesthetic, you know, some semi-viral news a few days before, and then also that bit of brand and community building beforehand.
And I think you kind of built it on that surprising bit of being controversial, which typically helps with getting awareness. My first experience with it was in grocery stores. So obviously you had a good experience. You launched, you're like, holy crap, this is doing really, really well. What was kind of the obvious kind of next step from there? Like, how did you continue on? The sales started to be really, really good and people kept buying, or did it peter off? What happened next?
Yeah. So for the first, even just like couple years, year or two, we were still manufacturing on Demon Island. We had a little production facility there and we could make enough product to fill the butcher shop and not much else. So we were making it there, shipping, you know, I was driving back and forth. James was driving back and forth, keeping the butcher shop stocked. And then, you know, starting to get into a few grocery stores, ended up moving production to Victoria. And once we got into, so first we were doing production in the butcher shop, but then we got a dedicated production space. And that's what really unlocked that next phase of growth for us. So figuring out how do we actually manufacture these products at scale? Because it was very handmade, labor intensive process, which I think is great, you know, that handcrafted aesthetic. But early on, we were in maybe 40 grocery stores. We were selling directly. So we're going store to store, delivering their orders. And that's really not a scalable model for a CPG food company. So the big unlock for us was production capacity. Once we had that, we figured out, okay, let's get into distribution. So we, you know, worked with, you know, two distributors, one out of Vancouver for BC and then one on Vancouver Island. And that's when the grocery store side really started to take off. I think it helped that we've been, you know, working for a couple of years to build the brand so that when it did start showing up on store shelves, it was moving really quickly. People were, you know, excited to see it at their grocery store. It was, you know, one of the fastest selling plant-based products, you know, in the area. And we were really able to leverage that growth into new listings relatively quickly. So into expanding, you know, initially inside BC, but then eventually across Canada into the States as well.
How did you fund all this kind of along those early stages? So from to even set up the original and the first butcher shop to then, you know, increasing production. How did you fund this? Was this through venture? Was this through family, friends?
Community-driven crowdfunding raised $600,000 for the Very Good Butchers while building a loyal customer base. In 2022 alone, crowdfunding raised over $17 billion worldwide, showing its potential as a powerful funding and marketing tool.
Yeah. So to get that first butcher shop built, myself, James, and my buddy who's in construction did all the work. So we did it very much on the cheap, found used stuff, put my life savings into it to get it off the ground. You know, we were there for a while. Then we moved to a slightly larger space, still in the same market, did a small family and friends round. And then our first real funding was actually probably a couple years in, and it was a front funder campaign. So it was an equity crowdfunding platform, raised about $600,000. Basically all from our customers and fans, a few kind of small checks from semi-traditional funds out of Vancouver, but pretty much that all that initial funding was from the community and friends and family.
Yeah. And at this time, where does the explosion of the plant-based alternatives, Impossible Burgers of the world, where were they at this time when you were starting to kind of experience this production growth and this scale through grocery stores?
Yeah, I think things were just starting to really take off, you know, probably 1 or 2 years in, all of a sudden Beyond Meat started making waves, you know, started coming into Canada. I want to say they, you know, they launched their Beyond Burger. There was that big watershed moment where it's available at A&W. So there was really quite a large boom. And I think, you know, Beyond and Impossible did an incredible job of showing people that plant-based has changed, that there's really tasty, delicious options out there. It's no longer the realm of like those burgers you know, put in your toaster and they're mushy and not great. And obviously they did a, you know, a ton of marketing, a ton of awareness. And that really helped us as well, right? Because all of a sudden people are more open to trying plant-based. There's these people that are seeking it out, you know, Meatless Monday, Flexitarian, you know, maybe they're not going full vegetarian or vegan, but they're all of a sudden open to trying it because they've had a positive experience recently or heard a lot about it.
Yeah, and it's similar to why did Tesla open source a lot of their information on the car, is that they want more brands and manufacturers to create electric cars because it increases the market across the board. So you started to grow into grocery stores, scaling with production. Where did you guys go next? And how did you guys think about kind of the future? Obviously, you have some big competitors coming out there, but those competitors are just really just helping your case and you were growing. What was your next step from there?
Going public allowed for rapid growth and helped Mitchell's company secure $60 million for expansion. While unconventional for food startups, the move aligned with a global trend for plant-based IPOs, with Beyond Meat seeing a 163% increase in its stock price on its very first day of trading.
Yeah, so we had all this pent-up demand. We couldn't really meet demand. So, you know, we launched this front funder campaign, expanded into a larger production facility in Victoria, grew sales aggressively. We did a lot of online as well. So a lot of online direct to consumer, which really took off. This was before all those kind of iOS and tracking changes. I mean, at one point, we still, even with the large production facility, we couldn't fill all the orders that were coming in online. So it was kind of a parallel growth. So growing the online business, getting into stores, I think it really actually helped us get into stores and move off of stores. So people would see an ad online, they end up buying in store, or they discover the product in store, then check us out online and end up, you know, buying a box and getting it shipped to them. That was kind of the next phase of growth, just growing the revenue base, growing the sales, still mainly in BC at this point, but starting to go, you know, eastwards into Ontario. And then we ended up taking a fairly non-traditional route for a food company. I think the traditional route is, you know, you do your friends and family round, things are going well, maybe you go raise a seed round from, you know, angel investors, then you look at, you know, a Series A with VCs. And we're looking at, like, we're looking at our next round. How do we raise, you know, a little bit of money to keep growing, build out the team, get new equipment, et cetera. Got some term sheets, you know, realized we'd be giving up a lot of the company to do that. And, you know, at the time we'd also gone on Dragon's Den, so had a lot of publicity there. And then, yeah, we went a kind of non-traditional route. We had an offer on the table for a go public transaction. You know, Beyond Meat had recently gone public. There was a ton of excitement in the space. And we kind of looked at it and decided that, you know, this route would allow us to remain in control, would allow us to, you know, raise the money we needed to expand. We went for it. I think we were maybe the second or third plant-based company that was publicly traded. And from there, things, yeah, really, really took off. You know, we're the top performing IPO of 2020, ended up, you know, going on to raise about $60 million, massively scaled production, you know, expanded across North America, and really grew the brand into a nationwide presence.
And at the time, when you say the kind of the non-traditional path, and I definitely understand that, what kind of revenue were you doing when you IPO'd? Were you like under 5 million? Were you over? Were you like 50 million? Like, what was your revenue when you did the IPO?
So we IPO'd, we were doing around a million in revenue, which is very, you know, very early. I think in Canada, there's this smart, like in the US, usually IPOs are all later stage, right? So you go, you raise a series A, B, C, D, IPO when you're, you know, 50 million revenue plus. In Canada, there's a lot more companies that will go public earlier and then they'll continue to grow in the public market. So that's where they'll raise their growth capital and they'll kind of build that story in public. So that was the route we went, grew sales from 1 million to 3 million to just under 10 million in 3 years. So at a very fast revenue ramp. And at the time, the, you know, for much of it, the whole market was booming and going crazy.
Yeah, the market at the time, especially in 2010 or 2020 and 2021 and 22, the public market was, you know, like you said, you know, growth kind of at all costs. But at 1 million and growing it to 10, that's really, really great. But you were valued at almost $1 billion, I believe, at one point.
Yeah. So just under, I want to say 950. So we were trading at 200, 300 times revenue at one point.
Yeah. And so a lot of people say, well, you know, it's a $1 billion company. That's all really, really great. But the underlying working of that is that you then need to kind of grow into that type of company. And so when you did the IPO, you raised, was it 60 million to then kind of scale into that?
So shortly before the IPO, we raised about 2 million privately from kind of the group that wanted to take us public, use that to scale up further, professionalize the company to a certain degree. Don't remember all the details, but yeah, we IPO'd, raised a couple million there. Things went really well. 6 weeks or, you know, 2 months later, we raised some more. 6 months to 8 months later, we raised some more. A year later, we raised some more. So the total amount raised was close to 60, but we did it in tranches as the company was growing, you know, obviously at different valuations.
And so from growing from 1 million to 3 to 10 is obviously really impressive. But, you know, when you think about a private company, that's really great. But when you think about a public company with that type of valuation, like where did you think you had to go to grow into it? Like, did you feel like you needed to scale this thing pretty quickly to a $100 million business?
Yeah. So that I think was part of, you know, one of the issues is it was, as you said, it was growth at all costs. We've got a $1 billion valuation or whatever. We've got to try to justify that. How do you justify that? Well, you need to get a ton of sales in. How do you get all those sales? Well, first off, you need the production capacity to support all that sales growth. So, you know, we invested heavily in manufacturing and building out that production facility, moved things over to Vancouver, you know, built out this great facility. And sales did grow, but they didn't really grow quickly enough to offset kind of the overhead there. And then, you know, as market conditions changed, all of a sudden it became much more difficult to access further growth capital.
Yeah. So you focused on growth at all costs, which means that you're burning money every single month. And with that burn and not having enough sales, at some point, this is going to kind of cause some problems. You then went to the NASDAQ, I believe, as well.
Yeah, we ended up doing a NASDAQ listing and a concurrent financing there. This was kind of to fund this big expansion. So I think we raised around $30 million in that round. This was to fund the big Vancouver expansion.
And at this time, you were growing, you're trying to keep up with production. How was the market demand for the product at that time? Was it still like a lot of investment in marketing now? Like, was this like, now we really need to actualize on this go-to-market strategy, get into, you know, every grocery store in North America? Like, what was the thinking from the marketing side to grow this?
Yeah, so market demand continued to be strong, you know, it continued to move really quickly. And it was same as that kind of original idea. Let's have, you know, two main channels. Let's have the online store that's going to act as like a marketing, brand building, awareness tool. You know, ideally it breaks even or makes a bit of money, pouring a ton into that. And then concurrently, let's get into as many grocery stores as possible. I think we got into about 4,000 grocery stores across North America, many of them carrying, you know, 12 to 15 different SKUs from us. So that piece was going well, but it wasn't, you know, it's just... With grocery stores, it takes time, like especially with these bigger retailers, which is where the more bigger unlocks go once you hit a certain scale. You know, you'll present, they'll love the product, they'll want to list it, but it won't end up on shelf for a year or a year and a half.
And the next stage of the story here is that eventually Very Good Butchers ends up going into insolvency or bankrupt. So what happened?
Good question. So, you know, stock was going up like crazy. Everyone's happy, you know, growing sales. Sales are growing, you know, triple digit growth a month or a quarter. Stock starts going down with market conditions. You know, we kind of mirrored Beyond Meat to a certain extent, which was at one point, you know, trading at 250 a share, is now at, you know, around $6. Stock started going down. We had a couple kind of activist shareholders that were upset, convinced that, you know, a management change was needed. They put pressure on the board, you know, waged like a 6-month war on me, essentially. I ended up getting fired from the company. My co-founder leaves at the same time. So, you know, with one move, they've kind of ripped out the heart and soul of the company, and which I think for an early stage startup is dangerous. And then, you know, the company wasn't able to raise the growth capital it needed to get to profitability. You know, I'd gone out and raised most of that money for them. I had, you know, all those relationships. All of a sudden, they've got a big facility, a lot of overhead, and not enough sales coming in to support that. So, you know, after I got fired, about a year later, they ended up going into bankruptcy or going into insolvency.
Mitchell's rapid scaling shows the risks of overinvesting before market readiness. Studies show that nearly 70% of startups fail due to premature scaling, underscoring the importance of sustainable growth.
But I guess if it wasn't a company within the public market, were the fundamentals of the business still strong? Customers were still arguably happy. Demand was still strong. Brand was still great. But the structure and the way that this whole business was financed ended up kind of causing it to kind of go down with the market. Is that a fair statement on the outcome?
I think if the company had been private, it would have ran into the same issues. If it had raised all that money from VCs, like they would have been clamoring for similar things. Okay, you got to grow quickly. Like you see it in a lot of Silicon Valley startups, they'll get a big chunk of funding. They'll invest heavily in CapEx. They'll build out a big team. So I don't think it would have been different had it remained private. I think it would have been more difficult for us to raise that kind of capital in the private markets. But yeah, you see other plant-based companies that were privately held go under as well and, you know, had maybe similar levels of growth. So I don't think it was a public markets thing. I think, you know, the nice thing about the public markets is we were able to raise quite a bit of money, you know, relatively easily at valuations we probably wouldn't have gotten privately. I think it was just a matter of us trying to grow too quickly, you know, overinvesting, you know, with a view for where things are going to be. Headcount was probably too high. And then on top of that, kind of at a pivotal moment when we need to be raising that next round of growth capital to take us to profitability, there being a, you know, huge leadership shakeup and, you know, a lot of key staff departing around that time.
Yeah, it's very difficult to balance the growth with profitability. And then obviously you factor in market conditions. Mm-hmm. But at the core, the principle of the business and the brand really still resonated with customers. And so today we're talking about the Better Butchers, which is 2.0 for you. And this is kind of that connection to this market opportunity of plant-based meats. And so why the Better Butchers? And what was your thesis and thoughts for starting a new company in this space?
Yeah, so I think love this idea of an alternative protein butcher shop. Obviously, a significant customer base that loved the brand, loved the products, large gap in the market when very good left. And for me, the initial idea behind it was, like, I've been very interested in the whole cultivated meat space, so lab-grown meat, and this idea of creating products that are the exact same as meat in terms of taste, texture, but made in a way that takes the animal out of the equation. So that was the initial focus of Better Butchers. It was that it was going to be a cultivated meat butcher shop. And that's what we worked on for the first year and a half, and are continuing to work on. But while we were doing that, we saw this really compelling opportunity and hole in the market, to be honest, for plant-based options. We're able to develop this kind of next generation plant-based product that uses this mushroom protein and products that's, allergen-free, soy-free, incredible taste and texture. So we thought, let's not wait until we have this cultivated meat product a couple years down the line or more. Let's bring some products to market now. Let's build out sales and distribution. Let's tap into that old customer base and start building, the business now in a more sustainable way.
The Better Butchers focuses on sustainability and innovation, addressing consumer demand for allergen-free, healthier options. The plant-based market is shifting towards clean label products, which 91% of consumers globally prefer.
Yeah, and did you have any assets at the end of all of this, or did you acquire any of the old assets that you had from the business before? Or is this all fresh and new corp? And I know you have a new co-founder as well.
So the assets, wasn't able to get anything. So I worked with Celeste in the past. She was one of our early R&D hires at Very. And so this was all new, but just kind of a familiar, I guess, look and feel. I mean, all butcher shops kind of look the same, but really thought there was something to this idea of an alternative protein butcher shop. I think if you look, there's not really any in North America that have really scaled. You've got the Vegetarian Butcher over in Europe, which was acquired by Unilever a few years back, is probably one of the biggest companies in the space. But a lot of the North America companies seem to be focused on that high tech angle and saw an opportunity and really was still in love, with this idea of an alternative protein butcher shop.
So when we think about market opportunities and thinking just strategically in this plant-based world, it's obviously very known right now that we eat too much meat and the cost to the environment to grow our meats is very, very high. So it's a known climate issue. There's also the health benefits of, we shouldn't eat nearly as much meat. There's options that are regenerative options. So regenerative farming that are trying to grow meat in a regenerative farming way, which they say is being able to capture that carbon and sink it into the soils and enriching in soils. And there is some really, really good evidence in that. And then you have plant-based meats, but all the ingredients are using plant-based materials. So, Very Good Butchers was, beans and other materials. And then you have the lab grown. This is the Beyond Meats, the Impossible Foods, grow it at scale in a very different kind of processed way. And then you're using mushroom as your base, which ends up being a plant-based. What's your just thoughts on this, if anybody's kind of looking at this space, like, we need to eat lots less, but we also need way more food in the future too. So like, how do you look at this just from the market?
Yeah. So I think, global meat demand is set to double in the next 20 to 30 years. More than a third of the land on earth is used for animal agriculture. You've got a lot of destructive practices associated with that. Large scale agriculture operations, factory farming. Simply put, if we continue at the current pace, we're going to run out of space to make all these products. So we need to figure out a new way to create, all these different products that we love. I think plant-based is part of that solution. I think cultivated lab-grown meat is part of that solution. At the end of the day, for the consumer, it's going to come down to a few things: taste, texture, experience, price as well is a huge one. So I think there's a massive opportunity. I think people are more and more open to trying different forms of protein. Yeah, you definitely have a lot of people trying to tackle these issues from a lot of different directions. And I'm really excited to see how things play out.
And is the market growing at the same time? Is people buying more plant-based alternatives year over year?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see some headlines in North America how, you know, sales are down this year or last year. And I really kind of see Europe as being a couple years ahead of North America in terms of kind of adoption curve. So a couple of years, these same headlines were going across Europe. Now you've got major supermarkets in Europe that are selling more plant-based meat than meat. So I think overall, it's a trend. It's not just a fad. I think, you know, in some cases, maybe some grocery store sales of whatever brand are down. I don't think it's because people are buying, like there's less people eating plant-based. I think it's, you know, because some of these products weren't delivering in terms of taste, texture, price. And I think there's new generations of products that are coming to market that fix, you know, a lot of these customer pain points. So yeah, I think overall the market is in a good place. People are more aware of options. People are integrating, you know, if they're not going full vegetarian or vegan, they're integrating more plant-based foods into their diet. And yeah, I expect that to continue for the foreseeable future.
What's different this time around for you in terms of your strategy over the next kind of few years from, I guess, both a business strategy and also kind of like a marketing and product strategy?
Yeah. So like first time around, really had no idea what we were doing. So as a result, everything just took so much longer. Like it took us something like 3 years to stop rolling sausages by hand. Mm-hmm. So this time around, we've designed the production process to be much more fast and efficient. For example, like our taco stuffer, which was one of our old favorites, took about 2 days to produce. It was labor intensive. It, you know, took forever. Now we can make a much better product in, you know, 30 minutes to an hour. So there's that piece of it. I think getting into grocery stores has been a lot quicker. We've got those distributor relationships. We've got the retailer relationships. From a marketing product perspective, we are looking to make that kind of next generation of plant-based products that are really delivering in terms of nutrition, in terms of taste, in terms of texture, and yeah, really just trying to take those learnings, you know, try to build the business to be a bit more sustainable, not over-investing, you know, ahead of time. So, you know, using co-packers and really just trying to build a solid business that can stand on its own, that isn't reliant on a, you know, ton of capital to grow. And at the end of the day, that, you know, puts out a product that consumers rave about.
Yeah, I think a term that somebody said, you have to meet the consumers at the table, and at that table means that the product is just really great. It's at a price point that they are comfortable with. And then, you know, kind of the rest is history. You can kind of grow from there, hopefully. And so is the strategy grocery stores online and build up that kind of brand, or is the plan to also have your own shops as well?
Yeah. So right now, yeah, the early strategy is grocery stores, support with some online. And then, yeah, at some point in the future, maybe open our own shop or just have like a pop-up in a market for a few months. It's not butcher shop first. Let's, yeah, get product widely available. Let's reintroduce people to this brand. Let's get product into as many people's mouths as possible. Because every time we do a sampling or a tasting, almost no matter who it is, once they try it, they're like, wow, this is so good. And they love that the product also ticks all these boxes in terms of being fully allergen free, you know, which our previous products weren't, in terms of great nutrition, which comes from this mushroom mycelium mycoprotein ingredient. So yeah, it's definitely a different approach, probably, you know, a slower build at times, but really want to make sure that we have products that are resonating and then bringing them to a wider audience.
Yeah. And the mycelium, like, is that something that you guys produce or you purchase from a producer in Canada, or where do you get that product from?
Yeah. So it's an ingredient. It's not technically a mycelium, but it's basically a blend. It's a pea protein and oyster mushrooms. And it just delivers on top of nutrition. The taste and texture is kind of next level. You know, oftentimes pea protein has a bit of a cat food aftertaste, to be honest. And you have to do a lot of masking with different chemicals and stuff. So yeah, it's an ingredient we buy and we're, yeah, really excited to be using it.
Funding model for this time around, has this been friends and family? Has this been, you know, some angel investors? How have you funded this so far?
Yeah, mostly funded it myself, some friends and family. We did a small front funder campaign earlier this year as well. So yeah, I mean, have the funds and just trying to keep things at a point where, yeah, the business can kind of catch up to where we want it to be and can kind of support itself. And yeah, we're growing pretty quickly. We launched products back in March, you know, already in close to 100 stores. And it's just managing that growth, making sure we can produce enough, making sure it, you know, gets to the stores and kind of slowly continuing to grow the brand and making sure that when we do end up on shelf, it sells like hotcakes.
If I were to bring you back in 5 years, where do you think you want the Better Butchers to be in terms of the personal growth and of the business?
I would love to have launched some of the first products in Canada containing cultivated or lab-grown meat. That's a really kind of goal of mine. I'd love for the brand to be a household name and to have really expanded our product lineup. So right now we just have grounds, but to be back in, you know, in the burger game, to have steaks, whole cuts, to really have brought back that full assortment that you find in a butcher shop. Those are kind of some of the goals. And, you know, obviously, you know, we'd love to be available across North America again, but in a way that is solid, is sustainable, is, you know, growing quickly, but, you know, in a more manageable way.
You brought up one interesting point there too, is to be able to bring cultivated meat potentially to as an ingredient. Do you see that part of the market where, like, you see ingredient makers, you know, Beyond Meat could have done something differently rather than be a brand. They could have been an ingredient, but you do start to see a lot of companies that are being ingredients, and they're hoping that, you know, companies can make their own products with that. Do you see that's a kind of a growing opportunity for your business to be a public facing brand, but then just use those, like, similar to like what a butcher shop would do, right?
Yeah. So I think for me, the real interest lies in building a consumer brand, in bringing products to market. And for now, at least, it's utilize the best ingredients we can find. At some point in the future, may look at vertical integration. But for us, it's, I just really get excited about putting something in people's mouths and them having that great experience and having that kind of relationship with the customer, either online or in grocery stores, and, you know, building a business around having that consumer packaged good.
Awesome. That was a ton of fun to talk about the Better Butchers today and your story with this kind of glue of market opportunity being plant-based meats. But what is the market opportunity?
Yeah, I think it's huge. I mean, in the next 20 to 30 years, global meat demand is set to double. More than a third of our land is being used for animal agriculture. You've got destructive practices like factory farming. And simply put, we're going to run out of space to make all these products we need and all this meat protein that the world wants. And we need to figure out a solution to that. We need to start producing these products in new ways. I think plant-based is going to play a big part in that, especially some of these, you know, interesting new types of alternatives like mycelium. I think cultivated meat is going to play a huge part in that as well. And I really think it's going to take a concerted effort to solve this big protein shortage. I mean, you even have some of the largest meat companies in the space, like Cargill, like Tyson, investing in cultivated or lab-grown meat because they see this shortage. They want to hedge their bets. And I'm really excited to see, you know, how the market evolves over the next 10, 20 years. I think you're going to see more and more plant-based and cultivated options showing up on the dinner table, and people are going to become more and more open to trying these new forms of protein once they realize that, you know, they taste the same, they look the same, they're healthier, they're just made in these new and exciting ways.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Someone Like You. I hope you're as inspired as I am by Mitchell's journey and his vision for the future of meat. If you enjoy this conversation, please don't forget to subscribe and share it with your network. And if you feel so inclined, please also leave a review. Together, we can keep exploring how bold ideas are reshaping the world. Until next time, keep breaking the rules strategically.